on a Wednesday. Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry.
Yes, Avi.
The seed of today's show started with something that you saw. Was it online? Where did you see it?
I saw it on Instagram.
On Instagram. IG, as the kids call it. So you saw, this was a video posted by the Wall Street Journal, because they had done an interview with Bill Gates. You know Bill Gates.
Yes.
He's pretty wealthy. Today's show is not about oligarchy. Don't worry. But in this video, Bill Gates talked about his upbringing and said that were he
a child today,
he feels he would have been diagnosed with autism. So that got us going, a whole roundtable conversation talking about diagnosis and autism, the culture of diagnosis, and why rates of diagnosis have skyrocketed over the last quarter century, along with diagnoses like ADHD and just a general cultural conversation around this term, neurodivergence, which is a pretty new term.
Yeah.
And it's not from medical literature. It really came from the grassroots.
From the culture.
So we're going to talk about all of that today on the show with a couple of experts. And we have a question for our audience, for our studio tubers, and for the folks listening. Why are more people identifying as neurodivergent or seeking a diagnosis of autism or ADHD? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. I already see an email I'm very eager to read later in the show. Or just leave a comment right there in the live stream chat on YouTube.
Yeah, I'm excited about this discussion because to me it's more than a discussion about medicine, but also how we define human difference, right?
Yes.
Once we put labels on things.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And so I'm excited to hear what our listeners think. And I hope you guys chime in.
Yeah.
So,
please chime.
Yes.
Chime away. Chime. Okay. So let's chime in on some local news stories, a trio of them. Why don't you start, Cherry?
Yes. Well, there has been a lot of confusion, panic, and chaos over the past couple of days over the Trump administration's order temporarily pausing disbursement of trillions of dollars of federal financial assistance. More details have come out about this pause from a memo that leaked that said, explained the purpose. They said the purpose of this pause was to give time for the Trump administration to sort of root out federal grants or loans that do not comply with President Trump's orders ending DEI, environmental justice issues, or that deal with woke gender ideology, among other causes. So they want to make sure that no funding from the federal government is going to those areas. And the White House press secretary told reporters that Social Security payments, Medicaid, food stamps, other individual support would not be impacted. But locally, there seemed to be a different message. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro said that the state could not access Medicaid payment system computers, that the system for preschool provider Head Start was inaccessible. Also, that the database for the career development tool CareerLink also could not access. The governor also said that over 6,000 state workers could be at risk for furlough. Now, I will say that all of this has been temporarily stopped by a judge that has issued a temporary order blocking all of this until at least next week. But lots of questions over who's impacted, what's impacted, which federal funds have been stopped, which ones will go through. A lot of questions need to be answered.
Questions and some say chaos.
Yeah.
And Senator Andy Kim from New Jersey basically put it right out there, said this is what the Trump administration wants. They want chaos. So then the question back to Kim and Democrats is, okay, what are you prepared to do about it? So this is the ballgame now. What are you going to do? If this had happened, and maybe it still is happening, it would have been incredibly disruptive to many, many, many people in our region. And so what, now you know, at the very least, if you're in the opposition party, you know that this is what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
so strategize and figure out what you're going to do to combat it.
Yeah. And my whole thing is, you know, there is a separation of power, right? Congress has the power of the purse.
Purse, yeah.
Yeah, and they decide where the money goes. And so the president really isn't supposed to get in that. At least that was the understanding. But we will see what the court says and what happens. Yeah.
Second story, which got our attention and got the attention of many people in the city of Philadelphia. Tuesday morning, ICE agents raided a car wash in the Juniata Park neighborhood of North Philadelphia, arresting seven people. This is the first sort of raid enforcement in our city of this new Trump administration. This comes as ICE field officers told over the weekend to meet quotas of perhaps 1,200 to 1,500 arrests per day. And then sort of talked about response, right? So the question, we also kind of knew that something like this was going to happen. And it will probably happen again and again and again. So what are local officials prepared to do about it? Advocates are saying, well, at the very least, step up, say something. And 6ABC did track down Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel about the raid. Do we have that quote teed up? This is what Kevin Bethel had to say to 6ABC after the raid in North Philadelphia.
ICE is working and doing what their function is, but we continue to work in that posture.
Okay, that's it. It seems short, but that's the clip. We don't have anything more to share.
And that posture he's referring to is sanctuary city status, because, you know, in 2016, Mayor Jim Kenney signed an executive order declaring that Philadelphia was a sanctuary city, which basically means that they do not cooperate with ICE, which means if you are arrested or you call PPD for assistance, like calling 911, they won't turn you over to ICE. That's all it means.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they stop ICE from doing their jobs. If they come with a warrant, they can't stop them from taking people and detaining people. That's all it means. And as you mentioned, Avi, I mean, the Parker administration has been pretty quiet. I think people want the Parker administration to reassert that or expand, right, you know, their protection of undocumented people. But so far, it's been very quiet, other than what we just heard.
Yep. Story number three, staying in Philadelphia for this story. Oh, kind of. Maybe going to Hollywood a little bit.
Yeah, this one was kind of fun. An animated series based on Kevin Hart's upbringing here in Philadelphia is coming out in the spring. And you guys should know who Kevin Hart is. Comedian, grew up Broad and Erie, right in North Philly. Well, the animated series is called Lil Kev.
Lil Kev. I like
and
that.
And it's set in
North. I could get down with that.
I like that. Lil Kev. And it's set in North Philly in 1993. And, you know, as I mentioned, he was raised near 15th and Erie. There's a mural there now on the walls of Max Cheesesteak. So you know exactly where that is. It'll be on BET Plus. And
I didn't even know that was a thing. BET Plus.
I didn't know either.
Yeah, okay.
But apparently it is. And it'll follow a 12-year-old little Kev who grows up in a rough neighborhood but has big comedic hopes and grand visions for his life. Wanda Sykes, who lives in Media, right here in Pennsylvania, she will play
Kevin. She lives in Media?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
She has a home in Media, yep.
Okay.
And she'll play Kevin's
mom. Shout out Wanda Sykes.
Shout out local
in the studio
people. She'll play Kevin's mom. So,
okay.
Yeah. And, you know, it's supposed to be a hilarious celebration of stories inspired by his Philly roots.
That Kevin Hart stays busy.
He does.
There's always a new Kevin Hart project.
I know.
Also, wasn't there like a show? So there was originally a show, Everybody Hates Chris, about Chris Rock as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like a live action. It wasn't animated. But then they did like a second generation of it that was animated, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's like a similar concept to that.
Yeah, and I know that if we're talking about OG comedians who had animated series, got to bring this guy up. I know he's fallen out of favor, but Bill Cosby, if you remember Fat Albert.
Oh, gosh, it is, yes.
Yeah, that was in 1972, back in the day. Yeah, but...
Whoa. Okay. Didn't even make those connections in my head. By the way, speaking of Philadelphia comedians, on this day, January 29th, 1880.
Ooh, you're taking us back.
Oh, yeah.
You do that so well, Avi. Go ahead. We're in the time ship.
Yeah, what am I going to say?
Timeship.
All right.
Yes.
We're in the time ship back to 1880, January 29th. That was the birth of W.C. Fields, born in Delco, raised in Philadelphia. Great Philadelphia personality comedian, and then had the great line. So it's been transformed over the years. But basically, he was being interviewed by a magazine, and they say, "What would you like on your tombstone?" And W.C. Fields says, "Here lies W.C. Fields. I would rather be living in Philadelphia."
Wow.
You get the joke? Like being living in Philadelphia is like one step above being dead.
Oh, God.
So he used to clown on Philadelphia a lot in his acts. You know, it's one of those things. If you're from here, you could do it.
But nobody else.
No. Boston comedian comes down making that joke. Get out of town,
you're going to get run out of Philly.
Yeah, but W.C. Fields, he really was from here. Actually, I would watch an animated show about his upbringing because there are some wild... He used to run the streets in Philly, or so he said. And then people were like, I'm not sure if he's telling the truth. But W.C. Fields did have some pretty fantastic...
That could be a thing, though. That might be a thing, bringing that back. Yeah.
Comedians' childhoods?
Yeah.
I would watch it.
Especially one that's no longer here.
Lil W.C., yeah. Coming up, we have our big topic today, and our question for you: why are more people identifying as neurodivergent or seeking a diagnosis of autism or ADHD? If you have thoughts on that, email us, studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. And now, usually, folks, data and radio don't mix. But today, we're going to start with a statistic because it is so jarring. Mm-hmm. In the year 2000, 1 in 150 American children were diagnosed with autism, according to the CDC. By 2024, last year, that number had climbed from 1 in 150 to 1 in 36.
Yeah, and along with this rise, experts say there's been a huge uptick in awareness. Young people are increasingly fluent in the language of diagnosis. They talk openly about autism and ADHD. There are entire internet subcultures centered on the concept of neural divergence.
So today we're going to talk about this rise in diagnosis, whether official or self-ascribed, and we want to understand where it's been helpful and perhaps, if at all, it's been harmful. So with us in Studio 2 today is Mattia Murray, who is the host of the ADHD Flourishing podcast. Mattia, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you.
And also with us in studio is Dr. Benjamin Yaris, associate professor and senior scientist at the Center for Autism Research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Ben, welcome to Studio 2 to you as well.
Hi. Thank you. It's great to be here.
And also, let me just say, and before we get going, I want to invite you at home to join us. Our big question today is, why do you think more people are identifying as neurodivergent or seeking a diagnosis of autism or ADHD? Our number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on our YouTube channel, be sure to leave your question or comment in the chat.
So let's start with a comment from Dandelion Greens on YouTube, who says, "Since autism is not diagnosed by blood tests, it's really only a question of whether a person feels helped by the information they learn as a result of a diagnosis. If it helps an individual, it's a good thing. But if it becomes so common that countless people randomly claim it, it minimizes the impact of what it truly means to be autistic." That's one perspective from YouTube. So, Dr. Yaris, let me start with you. We just posed this big question: why has there been an uptick? Let's just focus on autism for the moment. Why do you think there's been a big uptick in autism diagnosis over the last quarter century?
That's a great question, and it's not a simple answer. Part of it is the fact that we have more and more people in place asking questions about autism to families at an earlier time. We've done, as a field, there's been more awareness, you know, made available of what behaviors may count as autism. And so more people are, you know, when I was a kid growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, parents were not being asked, you know, about their 16-month-old, their 20-month-old, are you seeing these behaviors? But we are doing that now.
So more screening.
We also have changed the definition of what we consider to be autism over time.
The clinical definition.
The clinical definition has changed. And it is a broader definition, really trying to focus on challenges. And I think...
So what was it before? You give us a sense of what it was, let's say, in the 80s versus now.
Yeah. So in the 80s, a diagnosis, it has come and gone, but the it's still sort of embedded in current diagnosis is Asperger's. So Asperger's was not recognized as a diagnosis. That's well, now we would consider that to be autism without intellectual disability, without early delays in language development in particular. That was not, we did not understand that or consider that part of the autism spectrum back in the 1980s. That happened in the mid-1990s.
So you had to have you had to have these markers of delays in development diagnosed as autistic in the
80s. That's right. In the 80s and even in the 90s. And we didn't, so those people would not get a diagnosis. You know, in having conversations with them, if you talk with people who grew up at that time, they might say, I had challenges growing up. I had a hard time making friends. I was bullied a lot. I did these things that I felt like I was maybe different from other people. I struggled in these areas of life. And under the current definition of autism, it now meets the criteria.
And can you just be clear? So whether we all have a very clear understanding of when you say the definition, what does that mean today?
That's a great question. So the definition is there are behaviors that we have to see as clinicians that they are there and they're actually interfering with a person's ability to communicate with other people. So it's interfering with their relationships. It's interfering with their performance at school, meeting milestones, just in general, it's causing an impairment in their life and they're struggling. And when we see those behaviors and it's causing a level of impairment, that's when we make a diagnosis. There are some people, just as an example, in the definition, there are, you know, three categories of behaviors for social challenges. So there are some people that may not be really good at making eye contact or recognizing emotions in others. And some people may not have much of an impairment in their life because of that. Other people will have an impairment. When you have that impairment, then you start to say, like, okay, this is a behavior that's going to count under the checklist for autism. But if it's not causing an impairment, then it's not. It's just
human behavior. Yeah.
It's just human behavior, right? There is just variability in who we all are, right? We're not all the same. You and I do not have the same social skills, same spatial skills.
Right.
Same language skills, right?
Some people are shy, some people not so much, right?
Right. But it has to cross over into it's getting to be a different. They're experiencing a challenge because of it.
Yeah. And so, Mattia, I'm so happy to have you here. You've been listening to this, and I know you host a podcast. Can you just tell us a little bit about your journey before being diagnosed with ADHD and then later autism? Tell us about your journey both before and then after the diagnosis.
Thank you. So I definitely was experiencing those difficulties, those challenges, but I was born in the 80s. And, you know, the things I was doing as a kid, lining things up, you know, I was having really classic autistic behaviors as a child, but they weren't being picked up because I was homeschooled for one thing. That's a whole other rabbit hole. That was just not being picked up at all. But then also when I did go to school, I actually started college really young. So I'm also highly gifted. And that's another thing that masks the autism and ADHD. So then I got an incorrect bipolar diagnosis at the end of college because, you know, it looked like these ups and downs. But really it was, you know, the ADHD and giftedness, you know, up of, oh, I'm doing a lot of research. I'm doing monotropic deep dives on topics I'm interested in. And then I would have autistic burnout. So it would look like depression. I mean, I was also depressed, I think, because it's very hard to fit into a world that's not made for you. And then I think also another term that comes up in the autism world especially is spiky profile. So having some really extreme strengths and some really extreme difficulties. And so I felt like, you know, people were looking at me and just thinking, well, you're doing okay in school, for example. So you probably don't need help. You're probably fine. And I was very much not fine. And actually, one of the highest suicide risks in the autism community is women without intellectual disability because they just feel like they can't get ahead in life. They're just like, I don't understand why everything's so hard. I feel like I'm broken. And then there's just no support, really, because they don't have those super stereotypical outward portrayal of what people currently consider autism.
So that was your life before diagnosis. Yeah. And then you got a wrong diagnosis, which I'm sure was like, oh, my God, another punch in the gut. And then somebody said, okay, ADHD. Yes.
Yes.
How did that make you feel? And that was before they even realized autism was also in there. How did that make you feel actually getting something that was at least partially right?
It was incredible. And it definitely was life-saving for me. Both the diagnoses were life-saving for me because I went, oh, okay, there's a reason I'm struggling. It's not just that I'm broken or that I can't figure things out or that I can't, you know, make my life work. It's that I have very specific challenges. And say, you know, with the ADHD piece being first, for example, my therapist did not want to recommend me for neuropsych testing because she was like, you're okay. Mm-hmm. And then I missed three appointments in a row that I was really trying to get to. Like, I really tried. And she was like, oh, okay, I see it. I see that you're struggling. But if you don't have that outward struggle, it's just hard to even get recognized. But yeah, I think once I figured that out, and then there's the community piece, hearing other people's stories, and even figuring out accommodations that are maybe not the most traditional, obvious, you know, front level accommodations you would get through an institution, but just saying, oh, this is a thing I do to make my life work. Very silly story. At my birthday party last year, my friends had a 30-minute discussion about sock management approaches to how they deal with their sock problems. And I was like, yes, this is a very neurodivergent crowd. I don't have a problem. I have a system.
I love it.
I want to bring in this comment from someone on YouTube. They're commenting anonymously, or maybe it's Anno. I'm not sure. They say, I am undiagnosed but have privately identified as autistic for over 5 years. Learning about autism in women has helped me understand the way I navigate through the world, especially in the workplace, where seemingly simple social or work-related things have been very difficult for me to understand. That's a great comment. We mentioned this clip earlier. I want to play it now. This is Bill Gates talking to the Wall Street Journal, because we talked about this idea of people growing up in prior generations who may have had had some of what we would call the symptoms of autism now, but would not have been diagnosed. So here is Bill Gates on his childhood.
This whole thing of Asperger's or on the spectrum is a fairly new thing. You know, used to be autism had a fairly narrow definition that was, you know, clearly identifiable. But this idea that if you're slow socializing, you know, I have a behavior where I rock that bothers people, but that's also common, so-called self-stimming type thing. So I realized, wow, there's a bit of a pattern match there.
So that's Bill Gates. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Yaris, because you mentioned before the widening of the definition. Why widen the definition? How does this give people access to help, or how does it help people? Because presumably that's why you widen the definition, right?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we widened the definition because we realized there were commonalities of struggles that people were having. So Mattia's story is so common. People who are born as female, they are more likely to get diagnosed later. And it's because sometimes, many times, they may not present with the same behaviors at an early age. But the struggles that they may have in social skills or in some of the repetitive behavior pieces, repetitions, they do get in the way of their life as they get older, as the demands in life get older. And as a field, we started to realize that actually we're recommending the same treatments. The point of making a diagnosis is to guide someone to a set of treatments or supports that are going to help them achieve the best in their life.
And what might that look like in this case?
Right.
We talk about treatments and supports.
So, I mean, the evidence-based treatments, and I really want to emphasize evidence, meaning that there's been careful research to provide support, are supports of helping young autistic people or autistic people of any age, you know, achieve milestones that are going to help them be successful in life and their definition of successful. So helping them be independent, helping them learn at school. Those are the things we're really emphasizing. So when you see very young kids, we call it like naturalistic developmental behavioral intervention. And so a lot of that intervention is teaching skills of like words and language and feeding yourself and getting dressed. And it's all done through like play and natural opportunities, which is a big departure from what we were doing as a field in the 60s and 70s, where it was focused on, quote unquote, making people normal.
Yeah.
And that's not, I mean, in terms of where the research is and where psychologists who are developing a lot of these interventions, that is where they are going, of helping people gain the skills. So I want to help somebody communicate more effectively. If that allows them and they are interested in building more friendships, that's fantastic. If they are someone that does not want to build that friendship, I'm not going to force them to make that. I would explain that there can be some benefits to friendship and kinship with others, but ultimately, just like anybody in the world, right? It's your choice whether you want to have that relationship, whether you want to get married as an adult or not. So those are just some things. So the interventions, it's a lot of behavior. There are a few medications. None of those medications are about what we consider core aspects. It's more around people that have really hard time controlling their emotions. And then a lot of medications are targeted at mental health problems that come up as people get older. Anxiety, depression. those things come up later in life. And just like anybody else who's struggling with anxiety and depression, you want to support that person. So that may be a medication, that may be behavior, maybe both.
Yeah, I want to reiterate our question for today, which is, why do you think more people are identifying as neurodivergent or seeking a diagnosis of autism or ADHD? Is it helpful? Could it be harmful? Call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And I want to read this comment from Mary, who says, my grandson has both autism and ADHD. He reads 3 grades higher, but is socially awkward. Now diagnosed, he knows he is different, yet amazing. And so I want to sort of talk about, I asked, you know, could it be helpful? Could it be harmful? The younger you get the, you know, the diagnosis, is it more helpful? Because I want to talk, and I want to bring you back in, Mattia, and talk about this, because you talked about struggling through your teens, all the depression that came with not knowing. Do you think an earlier diagnosis would have been helpful to you?
I think so, especially in the current landscape. I don't know if it would have been as helpful at that age because it was so stigmatized. I've thought about that a lot.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. The thing I wish I had was understanding what ADHD was, and if I'd had ADHD meds younger, mm-hmm. there's long-term research that that actually can help essentially, I mean, it maybe has healed your brain over time. Like there's long-term mm-hmm. associations with living longer. It's really kind of crazy how ADHD meds are helpful over time. And mm-hmm. I struggled so much in school. Like the first time I was going sort of from homeschooling to a school setting, I was just in a fetal position on the floor because I was so overwhelmed. I was like completely, and I mean, you know, it's not just ADHD, right? It's the social stuff. It's the, you know, the sensory stuff with the autism. But there was a lot going on that I just wasn't getting any help for, and having the label would have helped, I think.
Could you help us understand like what it really feels like? Because I think we hear these things, we hear titles and labels, but people who are not neurodivergent, for example, may not truly understand what it feels like to be in a body where you feel that overwhelm because of stimulation.
Yeah, so the best description I've heard was a friend who said, it feels like I'm playing a game of Tetris that I'm constantly about to lose. Like every new piece that's coming in, I'm like, I don't have space, it's going too fast, there's just too much happening. And that feeling that there's just that next piece is going to be the thing that makes me have a meltdown. I still have meltdowns, even though my life is pretty well managed. I have a lot of support. I set things up very well. But for kids who are experiencing that, meltdowns can be really stigmatized. And if you don't let that physiological process work through the body, it can actually put you into then a shutdown for several days. So that's what a lot of what I was experiencing as a child is I wasn't letting myself have the meltdown. So then I would have a shutdown and it looked like depression again. So it was, again, having those kind of external things that look like depression and anxiety, because the internal experience of the sensory experiences, it's just too much. And that's just it. I'm just overflowing now. It's like,
and
a volcano.
It's like a system shutdown. Yeah.
Speaking of stigma, here's an email from Ken in South Philly who says, I think more people are identifying as neurodivergent for the same reason that it seemed like there were a lot more LGBT folks after gay marriage was legalized. They were there all along, but it didn't become acceptable to vocalize it until now. That's a perspective from Ken in South Philadelphia. You know, I played that clip, that Instagram clip from Bill Gates earlier, and I just wanted to read you guys the top comment, like the most upvoted comment on that video. And it's someone who says, a lot of people would be diagnosed now, agreeing with what Gates was saying, but it's given out like a disadvantage and holds kids back instead of just realizing they're a little quirky. Now, that's a random person on the internet, but what I take from the upvotes is that a lot of people do view it that way. So let me ask you, Mattia, what do you make of that comment? Do you think the label can be a hindrance for people? Is it always helpful? How have you seen it play out in your communities?
Yeah, that's a really great question because, for example, the ADA theoretically protects us if we have that official diagnosis, which is why a lot of people want it, and that does not play out in the workplace. If you come out at work, you are probably getting fired. If you ask for accommodations, you will often end up getting fired via trying to get those accommodations. And, you know, we just don't have the bandwidth to legally prosecute, and, you know, we just don't have that space. So the label itself, I think, can be very personally useful and important. And I see that a lot for individuals. Individuals say, knowing about myself is the thing that makes me feel like I can make it, I can survive, I can figure out my life. And that's the piece that really matters, I think, to individuals. And then the external label, the sort of official label, is not necessarily as helpful for us for the way society is currently set up. Even though the stigma is coming down, and that's great, and there's more understanding, and that's great. But really, when it comes down to it, I mean, I think back to a job experience where it was the first time I'd come out as autistic at work. And on my next performance review, my boss put that I had low affect. And I was like, you know that because you looked it up. Like, you are only like, why are you even saying this to me? And I was in a union, so I was able to make him take that off of it because I was like, I'm not signing this. You can't say that's bad. Yeah, I don't make as many facial expressions and I'm not as maybe reactive in an emergency situation, but I don't think that's a bad thing.
So
it's
that's
just
external.
Different.
Wow. And I think, do you think there's any people who internally, though, that they take the diagnosis as a limitation, or do you feel like that's uncommon?
No, I think that it can feel that way. And I have felt that way on and off. I mean, there's also a grieving process of just realizing, oh, these things are not going away. Mm. This is going to be my life forever. Like, I'm always going to struggle with some of these things, and that sucks. I think all disability kind of is difficult, even if you have the support, which most of us don't. So, you know, there's just that piece of it. I do think that can definitely happen. Mm. Yeah.
You mentioned disability, and there are some factors when you have autism or ADHD that can be disabling, but there are also factors that are superpowers in a lot of ways, because the other half of that Bill Gates clip, he talks about how the intense focus that he had made him perfect to be able to do coding and led to his success. How do you sort of get, and I know a lot of parents get nervous about the label of their children, and parents feel some kind of way about some of these titles. So Dr. Garris, I just wonder, how do we sort of educate people on the benefits or I guess the superpowers that may be attached to some of these labels so that they can sort of get over the parts or deal with the parts that may be more disabling?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I actually think it connects to something that Mattia said earlier about everybody having just sort of like a spiky profile, in that there are some skills that people have that could seem like a huge strength, where they're far outpacing their peers. And we can have like this halo bias, like if you can do math like this, if you can read like that,
right,
that somehow, why can't you put your underwear in the hamper, right? Like, why can't you do this, right? And that's the really, I think, important piece for helping to educate parents, helping them understand that, you know, most children are not trying to willfully, you know, go against their parents. You know, they're not trying to be difficult, and they're not trying to create more drama between them and their parents. And so hopefully, you know, we begin to talk about these challenges, these things that you're running into over and over again. These may be, you know, this may be part of that profile of autism. And so we help to try to educate them to understand that it can come with some great strengths, it can come with some challenges. And for a lot of families, if I'm doing my job right as a clinician, when I'm describing autism back to them, when I'm describing what's happening to their child, they hopefully will understand when I talk about the strengths and the weaknesses, they see their child when I'm talking about that. And that resonates. Even if they sort of have a hard time with the label, when they can say like, yeah, like that's my kid. That's who that is. I feel like I've done my job, because they're coming to me for an opinion. That comment at the top of like, it's based on behavior, there's no blood test. That's true. But it is expert opinion. And so we make the best decision we have with all the information in front of us. Mm. And so we try to educate. And I think it's really important when talking with parents, and particularly when they want to talk about the diagnosis with their child, of really having a positive framework, a strength-based framework, trying to think about how do you bring in that superpower.
Mm-hmm. And put them in activities where their strengths would be amplified. Yeah.
Right. Because ultimately, if you don't do that right at that first conversation with your child, they will walk away with the experience that Mattia had of, I'm broken. I'm not, you know, because some people will have descriptions of autism that are unfair, of saying like a core thing of being human is being social. It's like, well, so then what does that mean for that person? Mm-hmm. Does it mean that they're not human? No, that's not a helpful way. But so you have to be thoughtful about that.
Yeah. So we have much more to get to on the other side of this break. An email I really want to get to, and a call. And also want to talk about this idea of neurodivergence.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's kind of a different conversation, although it's a linked conversation. And I learned a lot the research for this episode. So I want to get to all that. Keep those comments coming. Studio2@whyy.org, or give us a call, 888-477-9499. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We are talking about the rise in ADHD and autism diagnoses, as well as the online communities that have sprouted up around this idea of neurodivergence. And with us in our Philadelphia studios are Dr. Benjamin Yaris, who is an associate professor and senior scientist at the Center for Autism Research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and Mattia Murray, who is the host of the AuDHD Flourishing podcast.
Our question for you, our listeners, is this: why do you think more people are identifying as neurodivergent or seeking a diagnosis of autism or ADHD? You can call us at 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on our YouTube channel, be sure to leave your question or comment in the chat. And we want to go ahead and bring in a caller. We have Rich from Media, Pennsylvania. Rich, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yes. Hi. Thank you. Great show, by the way.
Thanks, Rich.
I wanted to understand. I'm a little confused between the term, neurodivergent and autism. Are they? You saying they can be used interchangeably at this point, or does one connote more of an abnormal function, behavior wise? Or again, it's confusing to me whether they're both being used interchangeably at this point.
Great.
Thank
question.
You, Rich. And that is actually what we teased going on the other side of the this break.
Rich.
Yeah. Thank you, Rich, for making the transition.
You want to host the show, Rich?
Dr. Yaris. Yes.
So let's talk about this term, neurodiversity, neurodivergence, neurodivergent. You'll see all of this when you scroll around online.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people might be surprised to learn this doesn't come from the medical community originally, right? This is like a grassroots term. So Dr. Yaris, give us a little bit of the history of this and what it has come to mean, because it's being defined actively by a community of people out there in the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so, Mattia, you should certainly get your two cents in here as well. From being a professional and sort of watching it emerge over time, it's people who are recognizing, if you want to think about how does it relate to diagnoses that we use in the medical field, it's often diagnoses that are part of neurodevelopmental conditions. So that includes autism, ADHD, learning disability, speech language delays. Those are the conditions where people will often identify as neurodivergent. The most common, I would say, are autism and ADHD. But people with learning disabilities, I've also seen them sort of talk about it in the same way. And I think recognizing neurodiversity is also like recognizing that there is diversity in shades of eye color or shades of skin color, where we have that diversity and it exists out in the world. And so saying that someone's neurodivergent means that they, like, if there's one hair color that's predominant, it's like, okay, well, by saying you're neurodivergent, it's like my hair color doesn't align with the other one. And the same thing, that people have these diagnoses, like they are a substantial minority of the whole total world population.
And could it be, now I wonder too, because you mentioned that with autism and with ADHD, you really only get the diagnosis if it causes serious issues in your life.
That's right.
But you could have some of the traits.
Yes.
But maybe you've kind of created some workarounds.
Yes.
To where it doesn't bother you as much. And would neurodivergence sort of include those individuals that, where it's not interference, but it's not because... It's because of workarounds.
Right. It's a great point. And I mean, I would say, first off, identifying as neurodivergent, that's like a self-identification. Like, you identify as neurodivergent. But in terms of the diagnosis, I mean, those are great questions. And we ask that across the board. It's like, hey, someone can have severe anxiety and have tons of worries. But if they learn strategies about how to manage that anxiety, does that mean that they're not anxious anymore? Or does that just mean that they've come up with the right coping skills?
Yeah. I actually want to read this quote. This is from a 1998 article in The Atlantic by a writer named Harvey Bloom. And I believe it's one of the first times one of these terms was used in a printed publication. This is the quote: "Neurodiversity may be every bit as crucial for the human race as biodiversity is for life in general. Who can say what form of wiring will prove best at any given moment?" So what I take from that, Mattia, is the idea of casting this as a difference and a strength, and that there is strength in difference. What does that term neurodiversity or that term neurodivergence mean to you, and how do you see people using it?
So like a lot of people, I used the term neurodivergent before I claimed any of the specific labels. I was like, I know there's something going on. And then also another thing, one of my earliest diagnoses was also complex PTSD. So PTSD from prolonged trauma as a child. And that looks a lot like ADHD in the brain. So when I got my ADHD diagnosis, they said, well, there's a lot of overlap between these two things. And so basically, as your trauma gets better, if your ADHD symptoms stay the same, then we'll know it was ADHD the whole time. And otherwise, those two things are really actually hard to parse apart diagnostically. So again, in all that process, I was just like, well, I'm neurodivergent. Like there is something going on. I know I'm struggling in a way that other people just don't seem to struggle. When I hear people talk about, I mean, I don't even know what neurotypicality is exactly, but when I hear people talk about their experience of, for example, experiencing quiet sometimes in their brain, I've literally never had that, even with ADHD meds. There are always multiple voices. It is a constant stream of just thoughts and ideas. I'm an idea fountain, I say.
Right.
And it's just like it never stops. So some people get a break from life, and I don't. It's just high intensity all the time.
So you brought up this idea of like you don't know what neurotypical is. And I actually don't know what that means either,
yeah.
Right? Because I think neurodivergence does imply some sort of neurotypical, and the brain is so complex and every brain is so different. And so I wanted to bring in this quote. This is from a Psychology Today article written by a professor at the University of Virginia, Joseph Davis, just a couple years ago. It's this quote. The quote is, "We've medicalized emotional distress by putting it into flat, homogenous categories like depression and anxiety, and people have really picked up on that. The clinical terms are replacing our emotion words as well as other ways of talking about difference." Do you see, Mattia, a slippery slope in terms like neurodivergence, where people glom onto it and perhaps like over apply it when these are just sort of differences within the standard range of human difference?
I think a slippery slope is theoretically always possible. It's not what I'm seeing in my community because, for example, something I say to people is, look, whether or not you want the label or the term, because and that's also not my role, right? I don't diagnose or treat, so it's not really what I work with. But if the accommodations are helpful to you, if the sensory, you know, if it's helpful for you to wear earplugs, if it's helpful for you to wear sunglasses, if it's helpful for you to, you know, do different things around your food situation to make it easier for you or to wear clothes without tags in them, why not? Like if that's helpful to you, if it helps you live and it helps you, you know, have that lower anxiety or lower markers of other maybe mental health distress. Distress is just a word that I think about a lot. It's like I would experience so much more distress if I weren't actively managing this stuff. And managing this stuff is work, unfortunately. And it does, you know, it takes a lot out of me and I do get tired. Like I'm going to do one other thing today after this and that's it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This is going to be a very, you know, but because this is taking a lot to just be here. But it's also really worthwhile. So when there's something where I feel like this is worth it to me, then it's worth it to me to put in that time. And so that's where I see, you know, again, claiming maybe the broad label neurodivergence is very helpful for people because they don't need to claim one of the other specific, maybe more medicalized labels, but they can still find community and get help.
Yeah. Thank you by for being way, here, by the way.
You do not look like it is an issue at all, by the way.
Thank
you. Yeah. I want to bring in a caller. We have Joanne from Philadelphia on the line. Joanne, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, yes. Great show. I sort of self-diagnosed myself. I'm 73 years old now, but I self-diagnosed myself with ADHD when I was like probably in my 20s. It was mainly because I had hyper-focus. I could literally sit and work on something for 8 hours and not get up. Yeah, but it was very frustrating to people I work with because they had to like literally wave their hands in front of me for me to pay attention to them. And the other thing I comment on is I've been on a medication for this for like 30 years, and every time I go to refill it, you're treated as if you're an addict, which is pretty upsetting. It's like never changed the dose or anything. So that was my comment about that.
Thank you so much, Joanne. From Philadelphia. I wanted to sort of ask about, as more and more people, because we talked about the vast rise in the number of diagnoses, and we've seen a similar rise in ADHD diagnoses as well. As more and more people get the label, should I say, does it become less necessary to even label? Because we have, now it's like 1 in 36. Could we get to 1 in 20, 1 in 15, 1 in 10, and then 1 in 5, where it just becomes so common that it's not actually as big of a difference?
That's a great question. I don't think I think we will hit an asymptote. We'll flatline at some point. That is going to happen. And I think what is really interesting is that if you look globally, prevalence rates are converging, you know, closer to this rate where there's good screening in place.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So we're getting to a
so different countries with similar screening apparatuses are starting to converge.
Yeah. And similar rates of trying. Yeah. So you will see similar rates of autism across these other countries. And that is something that is very interesting because it's pointing that like there is a certain portion of the population. It's larger than what we originally thought. And again, for the reasons we talked about, more identification, more screening, more awareness, like those things have come together. And so that is something that is I do believe is going to happen. But to answer your question, it won't become meaningless because thinking about something, a condition like ADHD, where there is a medication that many, many people do respond to, there are behavior treatments that teach strategies. And when you combine these together, people have really good responses. I think that's always going to be necessary to know to be able to support people. And the available data that's out there, and people are always going to continue to debate this, but the available data is out there is that there's a large portion of people with ADHD that do, quote unquote, lose their diagnosis by the time they get into their mid-20s. Mm. And it doesn't mean that they have zero symptoms. There's a small percentage that do, but you have to have a certain number of these symptoms of ADHD, either in inattention or hyperactivity, impulsivity, to make a diagnosis. So if you have to, as an adult, you have to have five or more. You may have three. So you lose the diagnosis. Mm. But that is pointing to, and Mattia mentioned this earlier, about the idea of like, you know, the medication has, people followed them, you know, in terms of brain development and brain volume seems to normalize.
So you could actually heal, as Mattia mentioned, you could heal from use of the medication or grow out of it? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I don't know if I want to say growing out of it. I don't know if I want to say heal because, again, like when you're measuring brain volume, I mean, MRI is great, but it's like measuring a football field in like 3-yard increments, you know, 5-yard increments, like you're, or 10-yard increments. Like you're not getting that close to know like specifically what's really happening.
So many great emails. Yeah. I just want to make sure we get to some of them. Mm-hmm. Renee says, my 49-year-old brother has struggled his entire life and was finally diagnosed with autism 2 years ago. The diagnosis was a great relief to him and to our family because it was the missing piece of the puzzle for him. Rose says, I, like Mattia, received my ADHD diagnosis as an adult and as a child was considered to be gifted. I really hate the stereotype that autistic people have superpowers. Please don't put me on that pedestal because if I can't rise to it, then I have been set up
to fail. Yeah, and I did use that term, Rose. Yeah. I apologize.
Well, but it's interesting, right? Because that, I guess, is the fear, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, so for a lot of people, that's back-to-back emails, right? For a lot of people, the diagnosis is helpful. But if sort of the medicalized terminology becomes so prevalent that sort of everyone gloms onto it and then some people feel defeated by it or are sort of like seeing something that maybe isn't there, does that somehow hinder them? I think what you were saying, Mattia, is like we're so far away from that, you're not really worried about it at this point. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Pretty much. I mean, there may be some kind of, I don't know, bubble in which there are people who are seeking help and then end up not needing it. But I don't think that's a bad thing. I think the other piece here is a lot of people are struggling because life is hard. And for example, with the swapping of the cost of luxuries and living, like now a TV and a cell phone are cheap, but living is very hard. Mm-hmm. Like housing and food are expensive. Mm-hmm. So a lot of young people are just struggling and they're like, wow, my job sucks. I'm struggling at work. I can't live. Like maybe it's these things. And so I do think that's a piece that's coming in is like if the world is set up for neurodivergent people, it's better for everyone except billionaires, basically, like the people who are exploiting us. It's not
that was yesterday's
them.
Show. Yeah.
Yeah.
But to your point, though, right, this is an email from Joe who says, I'm a clinician who works with neurodivergent clients. Yes, we overdiagnose, pathologize in this culture, but we all used to be extremely insulated, uninformed and limited in exposure and awareness. So saying like that's probably the bigger issue. Here.
Yeah. And I want to try to get this caller in, Michael from Kennett Square. We only have 3 more minutes in the show. But Michael, you're on Studio 2. Quickly, we're almost out of time, but what's your question or comment?
I'll be as brief as I can. Are you noticing any variation in the incidence of autistic diagnosis, either geographically, nationally, or internationally, and also by societal groupings such as sex, race, socioeconomic groups, and so on?
And so thank you so much, Michael, for making that quick. And I wanted to touch on that point quickly because there is some differences in gender. Are there differences in race and socioeconomics? And if you could, I know that's a lot.
Yes. Yes.
Cool.
So, yes, I mean, generally speaking, people who are not white, not male, you know, are diagnosed later. And I mean, one area where I'd say the U.S. has made huge gains is with black children. Like that gap has narrowed where they're getting identified earlier. But people who particularly who are not white, not English speaking, still big gaps. And when I say that, I mean, you know, there's most of them are getting diagnosed after age 8, particularly women. Like women is where there's just a huge need. And there's lots of work on that for getting early diagnosis. Mattia's story is so common. It's very frustrating. So, yes. And regional, absolutely. Also regional differences as well.
And our anonymous Philly teacher says we need more trainings for educators on how to best support kids in schools.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could do a whole show on that.
Yes.
Want to read one more comment from YouTube. Artist Not says, mid-30s, and I would like to get a diagnosis for what may be selfish reasons. I want some form of vindication for my struggles, knowing I'm not just what others deem as lazy would feel great. But I think what I heard you, Mattia, saying is that's not selfish.
No.
You know, you don't feel that would be selfish, right?
Not at all. And that's a case where if, you know, if that person is reading the diagnostic criteria or just people's stories and are resonating with it, like by all means, use the label that works for you, you know, in your friend group, right?
It doesn't offend you if they claim it.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah.
Well, look, we are out of time for this show, but it was a really interesting conversation. And I want to thank you. Mattia Murray, host of the ADHD Flourishing podcast. You can download that, I assume, wherever you get your podcasts, right, Mattia? Thank you. And Dr. Benjamin Yaris, who is an associate professor and senior scientist at the Center for Autism Research, search at CHOP.
Yes.
Dr. Yaris, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone who wrote in today, to our callers, and to our producers. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray-Bester, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2, here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you and see you tomorrow.